Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Before we jump into our program, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, that offers a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper and has been doing so for the last 80 years. When you invest in MeQ, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's not a bank, it's a credit union. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. And even though there's no connection, we are talking about banks on one level here today on this segment of the Mark Steiner Show as we continue our coverage of what's happening in Standing Rock. There were demonstrations here in Baltimore and across the country at banks that are doing business with the companies that are laying the pipelines through North Dakota. And two of those people are with us here in the studio. And we was kind of spurred on by this by an article by Cedar Wilkie Gillette, who is a third-year law student at Vermont Law School, where she's majoring with looking at environmental human rights law. She's a tribal member of the Mandan, Hadassah, and Arikara Nation, and also Chippewa from the Turtle Mountain Band. She wrote a piece in the Yes magazine called "I Couldn't Go to Standing Rock, So I Closed My Accounts Instead," which is a really very interesting article, and also wrote "Pipeline Expansion Means Increased Violence Against Tribal Women" for the Post, which she also talked about in her other piece. And in the studio with us is Georgia McCandlish. Did I say that right?
McCandlish.
I'm sorry, McCandlish. I apologize. Cool. Georgia McCandlish, who was organizer for the Black Solidarity Friday action, which took place last weekend in Baltimore, where people were arrested at a bank, and shortly will be joined by Juan Ortiz, an indigenous organizer for Black Friday Solidarity, and was arrested in those demonstrations. So Cedar, Juan, and Georgia, welcome. Good to have the three of you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org by email. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook pages, but do join us at 410-319-8888. So let me just jump very quickly, Cedar, into what you wrote and the decisions you made about pulling your money out. But do it in the context, if you could, because you wrote a couple of things here that were very powerful about the role of water and poisoning water, the role of women in the Chippewa Nation, which you are part of, as well as how you've seen these pipelines create, because of the man communities that are created, create this violence against Native women. So if you could talk about those two things and that kind of pushed you into the action that you did.
Okay. Thank you for having me on your show.
Pleasure.
So I've been sitting with this for a long time, because the whole issue of this is fracking, the process of fracking. And how it got into my life is that I started working against it at the Turtle Mountain Band and Chippewa Reservation in North Dakota. We gathered together a group of women in the community under Dr. Carol Davis, who asked us to come together because in Chippewa society, women are keepers of the water, and that's the same as Standing Rock. Women stepped up and started that movement against the pipeline because women are keepers of the water. And because fracking was coming closer to the Turtle Mountain Reservation, we decided that we wanted to write a tribal resolution to ban fracking, and we researched fracking and looked at the different hydrocarbon chemicals that the companies typically use to drill the shale and into aquifers. And we've seen that from other communities that are already fracking, like in Demauk, Pennsylvania, and the Wind River Reservation, Wyoming, they were already having their groundwater contaminated from this process. So we were trying to prevent that contamination. And that was in 2011. We were able to come together and bring more of the community in. We called ourselves No Fracking Way, Turtle Mountain Tribe. We have a Facebook page. And we were able to present to the Turtle Mountain Tribal Council our resolution and why we wanted to ban fracking is because water is life. What would tribal members have 7 generations from now if they did not have clean water? How would we identify with our homeland if we couldn't live there?
Right.
I'm sorry, go ahead. So within 20 days from our first meeting together to getting that tribal resolution presented to the council, on November 20th, 2011, Turtle Mountain Tribal Council decided to ban fracking. And as far as we knew, we were the first tribe in the United States to make that happen. And they also canceled oil and gas bids that were scheduled about 2 weeks later to be opened up, but they canceled them on 45,000 acres. So for the water piece and the environmental piece, I was helpful in that way.
Right.
And because my mom is from that, that's where I was born, and that's where my mom is from. And I became so wrapped up in trying to do that work because already on my dad's reservation, the Mandan Hidatsa the Rikara Nation, they were already fracking. They were already into it. The tribe decided to frack, but in my opinion, they had no idea what they were getting themselves into. They didn't know how destructive fracking was or that it does permanently contaminate water. And it was unforeseen that all these influx of workers would come in. And increased violence against the whole community and more disproportional impact on the women. So I ended up moving back to my dad's reservation after working to ban fracking, and I worked as a tribal domestic violence advocate. So I was in the heart of all of that violence that was going on, all the influx of oil workers, the undocumented man camps, these communities that they built because there was no housing on the reservation for them. And women who would get into these situations, they would not either have cell phone service or a vehicle. So they were isolated in these unknown areas. And we would only know about them from the domestic violence program if they contacted the police somehow, or if they walked to the police station, walked miles to the police station to get help. And on the reservation, in 2012, our statistics were, we had 237 incidences. That's the highest in 1 year that we've ever had of domestic violence and sexual assault. And there was only four of us advocates covering 6 communities on the reservation over 1 million acres.
So I know this led to this in part. I'm glad you shared all that because I think it's important to kind of set up the reality of what these things are causing. And I know it led to this protest, your personal protest, to take your money out of this bank. And I want to come back to that, but I want to introduce the 2 guests here in the studio who are part of the protest here against banks in Baltimore. Juan Ortiz is here, and Georgia
McCandlish.
McCandlish. I don't know why I want to call you something else.
McCandlish. Everyone messes it up.
I'm so sorry. Don't worry. McCandlish. When I looked at the list of banks that Yes Magazine published that was linked to in Cedar Wilkie Gillette's article, it's almost every bank on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not credit unions, not people where people, community banks, but almost every major bank in the world is on this list.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So talk about the bit of the protest what you're doing here and people did around the country, and we'll come back to the story.
So
you were arrested, right, Juan?
Yes.
Right.
Responding to national calls for action in terms of trying to bring a spotlight to at least some of the major funders for the pipeline, and doing whatever we could to bring that to the national forefront in whatever capacity we could. And since there's a I think Baltimore is blessed by having young activists here who are already in and doing so much, like Georgia. And there's a real energy here. There was plenty of people willing to go out and risk all these things, risk arrest, because that's what exactly what the water protectors are going
through. So why were you risking yourself for arrest? What was the purpose of the protest?
The purpose of the protest, I think, above anything, is just to exert your right to protest, and in the process highlight that a lot of these financial institutions are the ones backing the pipelines, and like you were just alluding to earlier, so many of these pipelines, especially where I'm from, and I come from the borderlands of Texas, we work by aquifers, and so fracking, piping, any of the multitude of kind of problems that come with these processes affect us in so many ways. The lines that come up from Mexico are named after the people I come from, Tarahumara and Rarámuri. They seem to have a penchant for naming the pipelines after the people that they know they're affecting. So There's the Trans-Pecos Comanche one that they're fighting in West Texas that connects with the Tarahumara and connects with a lot of other pipelines that are all meant to kind of transport these fracking byproducts to across the country. It's a whole network of pipes and kind of infrastructure that they're building to transport a lot of that energy.
So what I think was important for the organizers, we ended up targeting Wells Fargo.
And why Wells Fargo?
So Wells Fargo is on the list of banks that have like an above a 4% stake in funding the pipeline. There are larger ones. There's Citibank, NTD, and Energy Transfer Partners. But Wells Fargo is a major bank in Baltimore City. It's also been called out and sued for its predatory lending practices and its racist lending. And part of the thing about the struggle for Native sovereignty in North Dakota right now is that that struggle is also on the ground here in Baltimore, right? So, like, our struggle against Wells Fargo, that connection of land grabbing and of like racist practices, that is something that affects people on the ground in this city. This isn't just a completely separate event or struggle for liberation. It's something that's happening here too.
So, Cedar, are you finding, when you wrote the letter to the bank and saying you were withdrawing your funds, are you finding that picking up around the country?
Yes. I've seen other people do it. Standing Rock divested. They passed a tribal resolution on November 1st, and they ended their 20-year relationship with Wells Fargo. I think it's tangible for people to do. They can see the connections of these banks to the pipeline and recognize that they are connected to it, even though, you know, not many people have gone to North Dakota or even know where this pipeline is or what North Dakota looks like, but they can be in solidarity with that movement by divesting.
Is that part of what we're doing here in Baltimore as well?
Yes, I think that's a national call as well. And I think that that's one of the most effective mechanisms, because if anything, I think speculation of any kind in financial markets is all kind of concentrated on risk. So any kind of backlash in which financial institutions can kind of feel unsettled by their investments is great. And they should feel unsettled by their investments because of what they're doing to our greater society. And I think it's just... It's a moral responsibility and imperative for people to place their money where their beliefs are. And that's one of the most effective ways in which really hitting people, hitting these kind of investors in the pocketbook and hitting them in the conscience and really making them question whether those investments into those kinds of projects are worth it is like at least something we can do, and we can do across. I mean, there's no end to where you can stand up and divest or protest So it's something everybody can kind of jump into and do. And since Baltimore has a real powerful energy in terms of protest and organizing, I think it's just one of many perfect places that can get together and do some very collective, powerful actions.
And Georgia, so where do these actions take us? What do you think they take the movement? What do you think they take this struggle? What do you think they really do for Standing Rock?
Well, I think in one respect, merely responding to a call for solidarity actions in other cities is a powerful move. And it does turn this fight into something that is national and something that is global and something that attacks the root of a lot of these issues, which is these like highly capitalist financial institutions, right? And the sort of like neoliberal policy of privatizing every utility and every collectively run or sovereign land that is possible. Asking individuals, our demands included asking Wells Fargo to divest from the pipeline, asking individuals to divest from Wells Fargo until they divested from the pipeline, and supporting the local struggle to rename Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day, which is something that Native folks in this city have been pushing and that has gone to city council before. So I think there's sort of three parts in there, right? There's like an individual action of what someone can do. It's funny that you had an ad for MeQ, right? Because investing in a credit union, that's a cooperative bank structure. That's something that is one of our transitions away from these sort of main consolidated financial institutions. There's the ask on a very direct level to stop this pipeline, because one thing is that the pipeline got a lot of money up front, but with a promise for like another $1.4 billion after it's constructed. And if that doesn't go through, if those banks pull out and don't promise that money at the end, then the pipeline's probably not going to be constructed. And then there's also understanding that when you make this sort of nationally visible struggle, like when you amplify it, when you amplify those voices, you can also amplify what's locally happening, right? There's like a much more sort of close to home issue at hand, which is trying to change the way that we conceptualize of our history and our traditions, and understand that like Columbus Day is a celebration of colonization and genocide. And I know some people disagree with that, but it's a celebration of colonization and genocide, and we can start to make conscious choices to change that at the local level.
And also, just to add, the native sovereignty, indigenous sovereignty, is a worldwide struggle, and it has many kind of facets to it, like the ones you were leading to earlier with Family Dollar, and there's a multitude of kind of issues that arise from that, but Latin America and Latin American indigenous people are just, that's been a constant battle for indigenous sovereignty in one way or another, because so many of the governments down there don't even recognize indigenous peoples. So it's one that affects the rest of the world in terms of that population that's been struggling for so long against all the kind of forms of colonization, which is one of them, and kind of the eroding of indigenous sovereignty and the resurrection in a lot of places of indigenous sovereignty, like you saw in Mexico in the 90s. I think it's important to realize they're all part and parcel of this continuum of struggles, and continuum of struggles by the same peoples that affect everyone else. So it's part and parcel of larger oppressions.
So I wonder, before we run out of time here, Cedar, I mean, one of the things, thinking about where you are at this moment, Vermont, but where you come from in North Dakota, and what's happening across the country, I mean, it's Standing Rock in some ways. I'm curious, I mean, if you've heard of other people kind of pulling their money out of these banks and really kind of trying to, and companies pulling their money out of banks. A Norwegian firm has, I know, and part of the Norwegian state has. But so what are you hearing from the other indigenous communities about the kind of solidarity that's growing around this?
I know that at least Cheyenne River is looking into divesting, or at least acting in more solidarity with Standing Rock. I'm not sure I haven't heard like individual tribes if they're going to divest, but I think individual Native Americans are divesting if they have connection to these banks. But I'm not entirely sure.
No. I think that one of the most important points you've made here, and I think it's really important for us, maybe we'll really explore in some depth the next day because we have to take a break here, but is this intersectionality between what's happening to the water, the attacks on women, and on reservations by mostly non-Native men as a direct result of laying pipelines and building wells and what's happening there and the movements around the country that kind of to push divestment and not to invest in these things from these major banks. I wish we had more time for this. We will come back to this. So, Sina Wilkie-Gillette, it was great to have you on the air with us. We're going to link to the two articles you wrote. I appreciate this work you're doing. And thank you for taking the time. I know you've been busy in law school. Good to have you here. Juan Ortiz, Indigenous organizer for Black Friday Solidarity with Standing Rock, and Georgia McCandlish.
Every time.
McCandlish. never again. McCandlish. McCandlish. Welcome, organizer also for Black Friday Solidarity. Good to have you with us, all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll keep on looking at Standing Rock, and we are taking a break. And when we come back, we continue our conversations about the legacy of Fidel Castro and a conversation we'll be having coming up. Stay with us. Don't go away.